That would be really intriguing, because they would have motives, certainly, having been involved in a scheme like this, but they wouldn't necessarily have the street smarts or the firepower at hand that the dads have access to. And what if it then, here we are rewriting it, what if it proceeded on parallel tracks that way? In the editing, you could have both fathers off on their quest and then both sons on theirs.
Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about Highest to Lowest and Honey Don't, starting with Highest to Lowest. So, Mike, what's the highest and the lowest in this movie?
Well, this is the new film from Spike Lee. And, on a personal note, I met Spike Lee in Baltimore once, heard him speak here a few times. He's dynamic with an audience. He knows how to provoke people and cause what the late John Lewis used to call good trouble. So there's a lot of good trouble around him. And the reason I wanted to preface it that way is just that there's some Spike Lee films I absolutely love. I mean, Do the Right Thing, an absolute masterpiece. Other films of his I like a lot. Some not as much. But you know what? Even with the films of his where I've got mixed feelings, he gets me activated. He gets me energized. I'm fully alert the whole time I'm watching the film. And it might be a checklist. Do I like this and don't like that? But you know what? That's more energy than I expend on a lot of other films. So I really admire him at that level of stirring things up. One reason in particular we picked this is not just because it's Spike Lee's new film, and that would be reason enough. But Marie and I are self-confessed film nerds. And this film, Highest to Lowest, is his homage, his tribute to Akira Kurosawa's 1963 film, High and Low. Now, one thing about, even though most people are familiar with Kurosawa, we tend to have, understandably, the automatic thought of, well, Toshiro Mifune in a samurai movie. But when you watch all of Kurosawa's films, he did make a number of films with contemporary settings and post-World War II issues coming up that way. And High and Low is a film in that respect. It's a police procedural. It's very much what happens where, a high-ranking executive gets involved in a kidnap scheme and then, demands for ransom money and so on. And this is where, you really follow it scene by scene because you're following the details of a criminal case. And it's one of Kurosawa's best films. So for any director to attempt, it's not quite a remake per se, but it's certainly acknowledging its source. And in fact, when you read the film's credits, and you should always read film credits, like Who Drove the Honey Wagon? We'll get to Honey later, but who drove the Honey Wagon? But Kurosawa is overtly acknowledged here. So Spike Lee it's more than just a tip of the hat. He's saying, yeah, this is my version of what, and that's kind of a nervy thing. You take a film that's a classic and decide to do your version. You know what? He makes it work. This is one reason it works so well is that it's such a New York movie. The opening scenes are gorgeously photographed, and the main character is played by Denzel Washington, reason enough to make it a good film. Denzel Washington plays a high-ranking music executive who's known for having the best ears in the business, as they say. And he really has spotted a lot of talent over the years. And as proof of his success, among other things, he and his wife live in this Brooklyn penthouse that faces the Manhattan skyline. And when people talk about a view that's to die for, he may die for it, but he literally has this view. And so the film looks great as it starts. And then as the story unfolds, you really do get pulled into it. Now, so I'll point to the strengths of the film, the source material. It's a really sturdy thing to work with. And it's a highly commercial venture. And I mean that as a compliment here. I mean, that kind of kidnap scheme and people living in swank quarters and all that, it's like really, and in terms of a music executive, it's easy on the eyes, easy on the ears. And I mean, that all is a compliment. It's really a pleasure to watch this. That's a strength. I think the greatest strength of the film actually is the relationship, not even so much between Denzel Washington's character and his wife. And that's well established, but between Denzel Washington's character, David King, and his chauffeur, who's more than just a chauffeur. These two guys grew up in the projects together. Their lives took different paths. Denzel's character goes on to be this high-ranking executive. Whereas the chauffeur played by Jeffrey Wright, and I love the way this is handled in the script, the characters, Paul Christopher, that we're told that Paul spent some time upstate, and anyone in New York would know that, okay, which prison, you know, it's that sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. But I love the way it's handled because it's referenced just enough that you realize he went a criminal path, and your imagination can fill in the details, doesn't get bogged down with all that. But what's significant here is that he's turned a corner. He's out of prison. His old friend, the record company executive, has hired him as a chauffeur and all around buddy. I mean, sort of bodyguard, buddy, everything else, counselor, kitchen counsel. He's all that for him. And Jeffrey Wright gives a terrific performance. And the two of them play off each other beautifully. And you just find yourself watching their faces for slight modulations in facial expression and so on. And so that I really love the first half of this film, the first hour, basically. I think it's really beautifully realized. I'll quickly say I didn't like the second half of the film quite as much. And I don't want to spoil anything in terms of the storyline, but it's going to involve both those characters, the executive and the chauffeur, having young adult sons. And there'll be a kidnapping, and I'll sort of let it go with that and demand for ransom and so on. Here's why I didn't like the second hour of the film as much. And this is where it veers most dramatically from the Kurosawa film. In the Kurosawa film, it's a very similar setup with Toshiro Mifune as the executive and so on, and the ransom demands and all that. What happens in the second half of the Kurosawa film is once the ransom has been paid, And you still want to capture the bad guys. In the Kurosawa film, it remains a police procedural. How are they going to go through what they need to go through to get the bad guys brought to justice? What the Lee film does, which I find somewhat disappointing, is, and because it's such a commercial film, and I've been saying that in a complimentary sense, but now in a less complimentary way, it hits a button that a lot of moviegoers respond to now, namely the vigilante drama. The second half of the Lee film has Denzel Washington and Jeffrey Wright's characters taking on that investigative work themselves. Not that the cops are incompetent, but that the cops really are by the book. Well, we got to do this and then do that. We have to send it to the lab for forensics, yada, yada. Meantime, Jeffrey Wright, who's from the street, knows the street still. He knows who to contact. Hey, where can we find so-and-so? And I'm not going to spoil who they're really looking for, but, you know, where can we do this and that? And it works. It's convincing. But my feeling there was not quite that it's sold out there, but that it simply hit an automatic button there, as in we like the notion of a, when I say we, I guess I'll include myself, the notion of a vigilante drama. Well, you know, the authorities can't quite do it. Not that they don't want to, but, you know, they're dragging their feet. A man's got to do what a man's got to do. Let's go out and hit the streets. And even if you accept that as a familiar template, one problem with it is there are a few places in the film, late in the film, where they're putting their lives really at risk. They're really in great danger. Wouldn't almost any of us at that point call 911 and say, listen, we know where the bad guy is. Here's the address. And we're a block away and we're going to keep our eyes on it. Why don't you guys show up with a huge squadron of policemen? But they don't. They tend not to do that because, you know, you want to have that ultimate showdown of good guy versus bad guy. And that's where the film, I think, becomes conventional in a way that still works, but I just find it somewhat deflating based on how fascinating and how original so much. And when I say original, I mean the fact that it really explores these relationships between the two guys, and it really explores the city very well. And of course, Spike Lee, being a sports fan, explores sports a lot, does all those things in a way that might not be novel, but is bracing, is fresh. And whereas this, when the vigilante drama, I feel like I've seen dozens of movies that have that same storyline at that point. So having talked almost as long as the movie goes on, I will turn it over to you at this point.
Well, I agree with most of what you said. I love it's sort of old school cinema. Like you're really seeing New York. I mean, I don't think they usually shut down streets anymore for filming, but I guess they will if it's Spike Lee. There's just so many real things going on, parades and ball games and, you know, people in the street. It's so nice to see that kind of film still being made for us film nerds. My favorite Spike Lee movie is Do the Right Thing, but that's actually the theme of the movie, this movie, Highest to Lowest, you know, whether you're going to do the right thing by your friend. And where I thought it wasn't as effective as the Kurosawa movie, sorry to compare it with the masterpiece, is In the Kurosawa movie, the two men are not friends. I mean, the chauffeur is a employee. And that made for a stronger dilemma, because is he going to do the right thing by his employee, just be a stand-up guy? When you make it somebody's friend, it's not quite the moral dilemma. Of course you're going to help your friend. That's not even a real question.
I beg to differ in the sense that I think it's more complicated with the way that Lee sets it up, because it's difficult to talk about this without spoiling too much, but essentially, because of the details of the kidnapping scheme, you have to decide what to do. Are you going to, in terms of ransom money, are you going to stand by your chauffeur/friend, or are you just going to, you know? And so in the Kurosawa film, I would wager that it's, when I say easier to make a decision, I mean in a very brass tacks, borderline heartless way. You could say, well, you know what? You know, I'm a rich man. I got a lot of money. The bad guys want this ransom. The guy who's the complicating wrinkle here is just my chauffeur. I can make a business decision. And in the way to say, well, it's too bad for the employee, but you know what? I got other employees too, and you can always get another chauffeur. I think that would be the easier, quote unquote, decision. When your chauffeur is also your best friend going back to childhood, and you may have to compromise or even go against that friendship in terms of whether or not to pay ransom money, I think that's a much more interesting scenario. I mean, the Kurosawa is a greater film. I don't disagree on that point. But in terms of the relationship between them, I think Lee made a smart move that way.
See, we're going to agree to disagree, because I feel like in terms of the main character, maybe the dilemma is the same. But in terms of society looking at your choice, I think people would just think that the Japanese businessman was making a business decision, and it's still contemptible, but it's not as bad as you sold out your friend.
See, that's why there's greater,
that is worse.
There's greater moral complexity with the way Lee sets it up, because, he knows what he should do as a businessman. What's the smart financial move? And this guy's being financially pressed because his record company's been sold or is about to be sold. And, you know, that's a whole storyline that's quite interesting in the film. But just giving a sense of the financial pressure they feel, that Brooklyn penthouse, they may have to give it up at some point. You know, they're really in straits here. And I don't want to get sidetracked with that financial aspect of the story, though it's worth pursuing, so much as the fact that this is the pressure. He's got all that financial pressure. Can he afford this ransom? Well, strictly speaking, yes. But what am I putting up, and for whose sake? And that's where the friendship is on the line in a lot of ways. And that's where it is messier, or at least just say more of a gray area as to what you should do. There's essentially no gray area in the Kurosawa in that respect, or not as much. But in this film here, it is a complete, I'll call it a gray muddle, if you will. And Denzel Washington gives such a finely nuanced performance. You just look at his face in some of those scenes. He's really, you know, you can see his thoughts there as to, well, this guy's my buddy. Should I help him out, this and that? Or should I just make a hard-nosed decision and you know, do this or that? It really is agonizing for him and for us. I think we're not sure, because I know the film's going to depart from the Kurosawa in various ways. So I don't know exactly how it's going to turn out as I'm watching it. And I'm careful not to spoil it right now in terms of how it does turn out. But the fact that he has to make a tough choice. Well, let's make a tough choice and move on to other aspects of it.
Okay, well, the other thing that I thought was I don't know, it's a different kind of punch. I don't know if I want to say it's better or worse. The fact that the two boys in the Spike Lee movie that are kidnapped are teenagers, I thought landed differently than, you know, the 6-7-year-old kids that were in the Kurosawa movie.
Well, to put you on the spot with this, I mean, push come to shove, did you think it was better or worse to have, I mean, I understand what you're saying. That is an interesting thing to talk about, that, you know, if you have the difference between like two kids and two teenagers who really are young men, essentially. They're at that point where you almost want to say, well, these are two young men, two young adult sons. I, again, just to answer before I get your answer, I tend to feel that, again, Lee made a smart choice here, because What these young guys do in retrospect was not a smart move. And again, I'm not going to spoil anything in retrospect, but they would have no way of knowing retrospect before the fact. But they're two young guys. And so at that age, you know, like if they wander off together, it's like buddies going off for a few hours. They're not thinking that they're disobeying their parents or getting in trouble. I mean, it's just like, you know, they belong to a summer basketball league. And, you know, it's like after practice, we'll go out and hang out with the buds for a while. So, you know, they're doing that. And, what I'm getting at there is they have a bit more agency, or they think they do, than if it were just like 6 and 7 year old kids, where automatically you'd hit a panic button. Like, you know, if you have a 6 year old kid and then you haven't heard from him for 2 hours, that's an emergency call, right? If it's a guy in his late teens, yeah, you're going to start to worry, but it's not quite the same thing. And I don't know if fundamentally it affects the story that much in terms of the narrative arc of what's happening, the kidnap scheme and so on. But I think it's interesting in the film because a second reason it's interesting or another reason is that you start to make direct connections between the fathers and the sons. Not that you wouldn't do that with really young children, but they're more tangible. They're more pungent when you realize, well, here's what Denzel's like as a middle-aged man, you know, his executive, and his son is getting into manhood. And so in terms of personality and decision-making and this and that, and I think it's interesting just to watch that. And then the relationship between fathers and sons, that's different when you have a young adult son. So I know what you're saying before. It's difficult to say whether one is better than the other, but I think it does set the storyline up somewhat differently at that point. But I put off your answer, so I'm sorry.
Well, I guess the thing that I felt landed weird in the Spike Lee movie was that the young men were old enough to do the vigilante thing themselves.
You know, that's a great question or consideration, actually. And that would have really made the second half of the film for me more interesting, actually, because we know that when you mentioned old school cinema before, you're absolutely right about that. It's one of the pleasures of this film, location shooting. Spike Lee loves location shooting, and boy, does he use it well. And so with the young adult sons, if they themselves had directly, because they're rather passive further into the film. I mean, they factor into storylines, but it's the dads who take over, right? You know, the dads have big boy pants. They're going to put them on and go off and do what they have to do. But if it were rescripted slightly, what would happen if, I mean, the fathers are going to do that anyway, but what if the sons, and particularly if on their own, like against dad's advice, if the sons decided, hey, you know what? I've heard there's an apartment up in Harlem, blah, blah, and they went on like that, you know, let's explore that block of the Bronx. That would be really intriguing because they would have motives, certainly, having been involved in a scheme like this. But they wouldn't necessarily have the street smarts or the firepower at hand that the dads have access to. And what if it proceeded on parallel tracks that way? In the editing, you could have both fathers off on their quest and then both sons on theirs. That would be really, you've made a much better movie at this point. Thank you.
No, seriously, the young guys, I think it would have been fun to see them outsmart the perpetrator who's not that smart. And also, I mean, the perp is not that much older than them. I don't know. I just think it would have been a stronger movie. I felt like, I mean, I don't mind a good vigilante story, but I didn't think that it should have unfolded the way it did. I think they missed a trick here.
Well, you're essentially, even though we've been disagreeing for hours now, an area of agreement is that I think the first half of the film is stronger than the second half. Would you concur?
I would, and I would also say, I as much as I liked the Denzel Washington's the woman who played his wife in this movie, and she had a good role. I think the Kurosawa wife was a better one. She had more, she was the moral center of the film in a lot of ways.
I thought about that as I watched the film because, you know, all of the principal roles are well played, and that husband and wife dynamic really does work well in this film, but she is very much a supporting character that way. She is the wife and mother worrying at home and this and that. The details are often spot on. The fact that, you know, because they're so wealthy, she would be a donor to the Studio Museum in Harlem, things like that, which might not mean much to people in 98% of America, but anyone with a New York vibe knows where she is socioeconomically. And details like that matter. That's what she would be doing. Spike Lee knows this material. So the scenes she's in all work, but it's essentially a guy's movie. There's no way around that. It's the two dads, it's the two sons. And you know, as a male viewer, I thought, well, that's what all movies should be, right? But maybe a female viewer would say, well, wait a minute, what about the wife? What about the mother? I think you make a really interesting observation that in the Kurosawa film, the wife has more substance, more agency, however you want to put it. And even though Kurosawa made guy movies, I think the wife in High and Low actually factors into a greater degree. Yeah, because there are scenes where the wife slash mother here is just, you know, agonizing off to the side, sort of like crying in the next room kind of things. And I know what you're getting at. But that at a creative level, that would create, I don't say issues or problems, but we've had this trajectory of the two dads, you know, going off on this quest. And hypothetically, we have the sons doing the same thing. You know, if mom were to also take part, she and her friends were to go. You know, she's on the board at the Studio Museum. You know, they're high powered people. They have connections. We might have a 3-hour film and every gender gets its day, I guess. I don't know. But you know what I'm getting at there, Marie, that it really would. You'd have to sort of like rethink the dynamics of it.
Yeah, well, one more rewrite would be that while the two sons are running around trying to get justice and the two dads are running around trying to get justice, the wife on the down low is the vigilante. That would have been a funnier movie, better movie in a way.
it would. It would be a feminist twist on it. Now, that would be sort of interesting. I'm not quite sure.
Brought down by, you know, people fundraising and you know, bake sales. But anyway, we could probably talk about this movie for the entire half hour, but we should move on to Honey Don't, which is, you know, an Ethan Coen movie, and it's apparently part of a trilogy that started with Drive Away Dolls, then this movie, and I think the third one's supposed to be called Go Beavers. So I want to hear what you say about this before I bring in.
Okay. We've always talked about the Coen brothers, and yet in the last few years, they've worked apart. And I don't want to read too much into that and sibling rivalry, you know, and even for years, you know, early in their careers, the Coen brothers, they would always have like, well, who's the director? Who's the screenwriter? Who's the producer? And they would actually break out the credits. And then they finally acknowledge, look, we both do everything. So it's no longer worth saying that he did the script and the other guy did the direction. They work together. Well, anyway, although they've been working apart, these are still family endeavors in this sense. Ethan Coen is working on his own now. As Marie pointed out, just last year, Drive Away Dolls was the first film he directed on his own. And yet his co-writer is his wife, Tricia Cook, who had worked as an editor on their film. So it's still sort of, you know, at the same kitchen table where a lot of this is worked out. I did not like Drive Away Dolls at all. And I know we've talked about it before. This film, Honey Don't, is at least marginally better. I don't like it particularly, and I think it falls flat, but it's familiar Coen brothers material. And Honey Don't, there's a private eye whose name is Honey O'Donohue, played by Margaret Qualley. And she's essentially a film noir character. Now, goodness knows film noir is a genre with which they are familiar, okay? Blood Simple and, you know, so many of their films that have film noirish elements. What they do here is potentially interesting. They're essentially queering the genre. What if we have a private eye who is not only a woman, but a lesbian? And you know, and that gets discussed in many scenes. It's not like I fixated on it. I mean, the movie fixates on that very point. And as a film noir character, she is dressed like and often behaves like a femme fatale. She's got the high heels and she's got like, you know, red outfits and all that. You know, she's right out of film noir. However, she's really not a femme fatale. She looks like one. She's actually closer to a Humphrey Bogart type private eye, the way she talks and all. So it is somewhat, and she's out in Bakersfield, California, which is a good place to set a story like this one. She's essentially a film noir character. I dare say this may be overly familiar material for the Coens by now. It's just like, well, we've been there, we've done that. It's a retread that way. But the real problem here is the film, to its credit, has a tight running time of 88 minutes. But there's so much story packed into it. And you could say, well, it's a film noir, twists and turns. And yeah, I agree with all that. But so many of the twists and turns seem arbitrary. The material is really forced. And it's just not as funny as it thinks it is. So in terms of relationships and story tangents and all, borderline implausible at times, or at least not fully developed. And it's almost like, the director and screenwriter keep hitting buttons that are meant to get a rise out of the audience. Because there are some rather extreme scenes, whether in terms of sexuality or violence or all the above. And yet I oftentimes felt not that I was moved or jolted by that so much as just that, you know, they're trying to get a rise out of me here. And then the next scene is almost disconnected. It's like, well, let's do this next. And it seems sort of tossed together, kind of hasty that way. It doesn't seem like it's fully thought through. It almost seems like a first draft. What the idea is you'd throw around the table, but then they just pick up the camera and that's what they shoot. So let me throw it back on your table. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's funny. I had a Baltimore reference when I was listening to you talking about when you said Coen brothers. I thought, you know, it's interesting. In Baltimore, we were all about, you know, the Coen sisters.
Well, the spelling is different.
The spelling's different, but it sounds the same. But both, you know, are trying to create art. Now, did Ethan Coen succeed here? I think this movie is a hot mess, but I loved Margaret Qualley in this. Having seen her in The Substance, which, you know, I liked a lot better than you did, this was so different. And I thought she did wonderfully with those deadpan lines. And when I saw it, it was on, you know, cheap Tuesday where all the tickets are $5. So there's a lot more people in the audience. She brought down the house with several of her one-liners. So I'm going to say the movie's not that great, but watch it. I was just waiting for them to give her another great line to deliver, because I thought she was fabulous in this.
It is the kind of movie you should see on a $5 Tuesday. It's true. and her line readings really are spot on. They are. I mean, she looks just right for the part. She has really good timing with it. Some of the lines are funny. Some only work because the performance itself works. I mean, they're not particularly funny or witty on their own. But that's, again, where it often seemed forced to me. It's like the setup for a scene, and then here's the line, and, you know, deliver the line, wait a beat. And you hope the audience laughs, and they do sometimes. But other times, at least the audience I saw it with, there was silence, you know, people just watched it. I watched it with an admittedly small house because it wasn't a $5 Tuesday. But the deal is, I don't think it's entertaining in the sense that it's relentless. It's not boring exactly, because something's always happening. And her performance, I agree with you, her performance is what really holds it together. If it weren't for such a strong presence that she has, the rest of it, and we can talk about supporting characters, but they all just sort of float on and float away. You know, there's not much, you know, is it a subplot or the plot? You don't even know after a while, but Chris Evans plays a reverend in this who runs what's called the Four-Way Temple. And you know what? It's a lot of hoo-ha that doesn't add up to anything. I mean, I want to get your take on this. I mean, you know, it's not exactly surprising that sometimes men of the cloth are not exactly devout. You know, he's probably the worst of the worst. And I'm not giving too much away there. The moment he comes on, you know, that's a slime ball, you think. But he runs this church. And you would think, well, that could be potentially interesting, whether you're religious or not. I mean, there's a satirical edge to this that, you know, this supposed man of God is quite godless in a lot of ways. But those scenes are tossed in, again, almost in the sense of hitting a button, like, well, now look what he's doing. And I never had much real sense of, well, what's this church really like? And what's his deal? What's his psychology? It's not really explored, is it? I mean, it's just there.
No, it's just he knows how to take advantage of people by posing as this, you know, irreverent reverend. No, the Chris Evans part really, I think, tanked the movie the most, because a little bit's funny. Giving it that much was just, I don't know, cringeworthy and a terrible role for him. But I'm going to go back to Margaret Qualley. What I was thinking when I left that theater was that movie was not that great, but I would like to see that character again. I could see her reprising that in a better movie. That made more sense, because I thought she brought it. I thought she brought an A game I didn't think she had in her. And I couldn't help but think of Andy McDowell watching her also.
Yeah, I did too, actually. I was reminded. I mean, the physical structure, there's a resemblance there, but also the personality, though, that dry line delivery sometimes. Yeah, the long takes that way. Well, you know, the Coens tend to work, have often worked with the same actors, and she's a case in point. So I think you'll get your dream come true again. I mean, I think you'll be seeing her again.
Well, I just think she was a surprise. I didn't see, I had no expectations going in, but, you know, having seen her in The Substance, I thought, well, you know, she's a pretty face. But I thought she brought down the house. I'm telling you, there were, not only were there people laughing, I mean, there were people snorting with laughter. I must have seen it with all the people that this movie must have been made for.
Well, I think my audience was snorting something else. So.
Well, that does bring us to the end of our show. But don't forget to check out our other podcasts at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.